Go on, Gert. Give us your one to begin with.
Are you in deep trouble now? Yeah. Well, thanks for thinking for me there. You know, I think what we're seeing here, this is quite interesting. I think we're seeing a huge culture clash. I mean, we have a culture of traditional media saying that control equals money, right? Copyright is sacrosanct, yeah? You make a copy, you pay. So control equals money. That's the old way. And then we have all the new guys saying, hey, you know, it's trust equals money. Or attention equals money. And that goes for food, too, and the other things, right? So this is quite an interesting angle, because really, you're talking about a huge shift, right? Anybody who's made money with control, like, you know, airlines, banks, insurance, the record labels, the broadcasters, now they're all shifting towards making money with attention or trust or whatever you want to call it. And I think this is a huge shift that's going to keep us busy for quite some time. It means that in the process of this changing, there's a lot of fallout, right? Like music is basically, I agree with Umair, is basically dead, right? Music industry sucks, has to be killed and reinvented, right? Maybe MySpace is on Last of Emma doing this. So, you know, this shift from control to trust, I think that's crucial. I hear that with all the comments that we had so far, just as a summary.
Okay, do you want to come back to that, Umair? You see you grasping your microphone.
Yeah, I mean, I could speak to it for a second. Yeah, I think it's very true, Gerd. But you know, the bigger point is, you know, so a lot of companies are now starting to think about how do we lose control, and they're big companies, right? So Procter & Gamble, one of the biggest companies in the world, is now shifting to a model where they, you know, share innovation with their competitors. So that's fundamentally losing control. You know, you're right. We're still obsessed with it in media. And it's ridiculous, you know, because the entire world, you know, Procter & Gamble, this gigantic evil company, is moving beyond these stale, idiotic assumptions. And in media, we're still riddled by them. So I think it's pathetic.
But of course, you know, I think the key there is where do you want to lose it and where do you have to keep it? I mean, look at Google, which up to now was a good example for open, right? The core of what they do is completely closed. Nobody knows the ad algorithm exactly. Maybe they open this up now. I don't know. Microsoft, sure. Completely closed. Now they want to be open, right? So it's not as easy as black and white, I guess.
No, I don't think it's easy, but I don't think we're trying very much either. So.
Yeah, but everything you're suggesting is that the stakes are very high, and that for a media owner, for instance, in this environment, the risk has to be enormous. That the functionality or the content that they let go of turns out to be the crown jewels and represent epic dilution of their P&L.
Well, I mean, look, frankly, I think the risk is enormous. I don't want to hog the mic. I want to really let these guys talk. But you know, you look at what Craigslist did to the newspapers in the States. I mean, you know, the risk couldn't be any greater for most of the traditional media companies, right? I mean, the game is over for them. If they don't reinvent their businesses, they're not going to last more than another 5 or 10 years. And everybody, frankly, knows it. So I think the stakes are very high. I think we are in a really strange place right now where we can't let go of the past, and the future is kind of already moving beyond us. You know, the old industrial dinosaurs are getting with it, and there's a whole raft of new revolutionaries that are going to solve these problems in healthcare, education, finance, food. You know, maybe they're not in this room, which is unfortunate.
Right, let's see if we can bring in a couple of people from the audience. Now, we've got one hand waving over by the bar. Tell us who you are. Yeah, that's good. Speak up.
My name is Paul Fisher. I work for Advent Ventures, which is a venture capital investor. And I'm just interested in what the panel think about where value is being created. You know, we talk about the record industry, and in short, there's not as much revenue being generated in that industry, which means it can't employ as many people, which means lots of people are losing their jobs. Similarly, in the media industry, you know, will The Guardian be employing as many journalists in 5 years as it is today? You know, we don't know. So, you know, my job is to invest in growing industries, and I wonder if the panel can identify one of them.
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? There's the role of an established business is to edge forward while creating new sources of value while jealously protecting the existing value base, isn't it? But obviously this whole form creates for us the potential of massively destructive new sources of value that might eat the old sources of value. Now, who wants to have a go at that question?
Yeah.
Miles.
It's an interesting point and very well made. The fundamentals for me are, and I'd put the question back to Havas as well, the media agencies and the advertising agencies are dinosaurs. You know, they control billions of pounds worth of spend, and where does the billions of pounds worth of spend still go? It's not supporting where the audience is migrating to. So, yes, advertisers still need to reach an audience. They've still got to sell a product, whether that's a car, an insurance product, or, you know, a box of washing up liquid. But the fundamentals are that you walk into an agency and they are controlling the spend and they are putting it on TV, give or take a bit. You know, or they're putting 60% of it in search, which works for certain brands. So I'd like to push that right back to Havas.
Okay, so
I should point out that Umair probably doesn't necessarily identify with Havas.
Doesn't he do media plans? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sort of a robotic Havas over here, but let me reframe Paul's question and your reply. Look, the fundamental problem at the heart of media that's really, you know, killing all of us, and it's causing Paul to question whether he should, look for returns in this industry, is the fact that we have spent, you know, 2 or 3 years facing this fundamental question, and we haven't dealt with it, which is, and it's a smaller question than the previous ones I was talking about, and the question is this: how do we reinvent brands, yeah? So the big money is in reinventing branding. How do we do it? Media is lame today. We're shoving, you know, banner ads at people. You know, it's something we've been doing for 15 years. It's idiotic, right? I mean, why are we doing this in 2008? Why can we not reinvent brands? So do agencies suck? Yeah, I agree. Okay, fine. Agencies suck. But you know what? I mean, MySpace has had 3 years, and I'm disappointed, frankly, that you guys haven't brought agencies a proposition that really reinvents brands. One of the things I've been talking about endlessly on my Harvard blog is this idea that we have to make brands about listening and not about talking, right? Nobody wants to be talked at by a goddamn brand in this day and age. It's ridiculous to think that you would want that. So why can MySpace not bring that kind of proposition? I think MySpace is one of the few places that should bring that proposition to advertisers. Say, hey, you know what? We can fundamentally rethink what a brand is for you, what benefits it delivers to you. It's not just a vehicle to sort of carpet bomb consumers with this message that nobody believes anymore, if that makes sense.
I think we're going to come back to this issue through the evening, but let's open up again, hopefully, a little bit, and then we'll circle back around to that point. Question there on the second sofa. Tell us who you are.
Rishi Dastanov from Archibald Ingalls Stretton, which recently joined Havas. And just actually to that point, you know, agencies not necessarily following where the audience is. Like that last FM figure, you know, for the widgets from 350,000, you know, Coronation Street still gets 10 million people. You know, there's a reason why we're not necessarily following as quickly as everyone would like to be. And, yeah, that's simply, you know, the audience aren't being generated. So, you know, before this turns into a blame storm, there is also a level at which, you know, yeah, sure, we're not necessarily moving as quickly as we are, but don't forget, everyone outside of this room, people who are living, dare I say it, in the real world, are not necessarily moving as quickly as everyone is thinking as well. So let's not necessarily get carried away here. And the other point is, you know, old technology doesn't die. Old media doesn't die. People use it in different ways, but it doesn't fall off the face of the planet.
So yeah. How many people do you think are going to watch Coronation Street in 5 years, in 10 years?
They're still going to watch it. It's not necessarily going to be at 7:30. But my point is, yes, it's fallen from, you know, 19 million that it might have been 5-6 years ago, but still a residual core of 10 million on Monday night at 7:30. These are still big figures. These are not to be chucked out lightly.
Steve, sorry. But you know, if you look at the music business, we're going from the paid copy to free access, right? I mean, that's these guys here, right? So basically what happened, we used to pay for music, now we get it for free by clicking somewhere, right? And that has happened for software, for phone calls, for all these other things, right? So I agree with the person from Advent. You know, I think the real opportunity is in disruption. Anything that disrupts, if you invest early enough, should be good. Right, because that is the next. We don't really know what the next world success story is, the next Google, if you wish, or if you're looking for that kind of marginal thing. But, those kind of things, disruption is really what we should be funding. And that's, I think that's our job to bring that about, looks to me.
Okay, good. Neil?
I was just going to add, I mean, if we imagine for a second that Coronation Street is quality content, again, it comes I hate it with a passion, but let's imagine lots of people love it in the real world. That's great. Surely the place it sucks to be is being ITV1. But as people said up the back, you're going to watch it online, you might watch it elsewhere. I mean, ITV produce Coronation Street, don't they? So it's probably a poor example, but there are lots of really big production companies whose valuations are rocketing, and where that looks a really interesting place to be, because they're really good at hanging on to the rights for digital stuff already. They're getting only stronger at clinging on to those. They're practically only granting rights to the TV channels to show it, you know, to shove it out for the first time, and then they keep everything else online, all the amazing value that sits online. So as that continues to develop, there you can see value. That's where your value lies. There's stuff happening there right now. You can begin to see all this evolving. One big up for the old world in a slightly horrible way, and let's not forget that Richard Desmond is extracting tens of millions of pounds out of the Daily Express. There is still money locked in old media.
Okay. We've already triggered about five or six different directions for the debate, and I'm very excited. I'd like to ask about 12 questions myself. I know that you want to come back with a response first, Umair.
Oh, it's really quick. The reason that I asked you, how many people do you think will be watching that, is that the fundamental problem in media today is that we're clinging to a set of assumptions that were made for an era of mass everything, right? So why do you care how many people watch Coronation Street? If you can make brands that are about listening instead of talking, you shouldn't care. Your assumption is that somehow you will be able to piggyback commercial messages, yeah, onto Coronation Street itself. But that's the past. I don't accept that that will be the future. Because in a world where consumers have control and we're all more interconnected, those kinds of costs cannot be borne.
Okay, but what will they be listening to? It's all very well.
Your assumption is always that we will have to... You see what I'm saying? Your assumption is that we'll always have to piggyback some kind of message onto something. We'll always have to talk to people.
Yeah, and I'm accepting the assumption, but my point is it's fine to say, yeah, brands will be built about listening. That implies that there is a conversation happening. That implies there is something being talked to and talked about and talked at. So, you know, where is the other side of that thing happening from? I come back to the point that, you know, when people absorb and incorporate new technologies into their lives, it doesn't mean that people, you know, things stop being used immediately, that they fall, you know, that they fall off a cliff. They don't. You know, it's a slower process of negotiation that has to occur in this shift that's going on. And it, you know, the reinvention thing is not going to happen overnight.
I love this debate. 15 years of listening to this debate is so fascinating. And I know that... I seriously do, because, of course, it's so fundamental to our economy and so important that we get this right. But I always find myself standing somewhere in between the gradualists and these kind of digital hooligans up here. If they hadn't been so impeccably socialised, they'd probably be serving as bows as we speak, wouldn't we? But one of the things I find fascinating here is that the big break on our exciting forward movement is this business of shareholder capitalism, which means that the chief executive of Kellogg's can't go to the annual general meeting and say, well, you know, we turned Crunchy Nut Cornflakes into a listening brand. Look, 90% of our sales.
That's 100% wrong, and I'll give you an example how. You know, Procter & Gamble just set up a media lab, and their goal is very simple. It's to make brands that are about listening, and it's to fundamentally disintermediate all of the agencies and all of the bullshit from this stuff. So these changes are happening, and they are radical, and I think we are, unfortunately, way behind the curve, and I'll keep sending you this message that the most innovative companies in the world today are not even sort of Google and unfortunately, you know, MySpace and Last.fm, no offense, guys, but today I think it really is, and it hurts me to say it because I hate big companies. Our guys like Procter & Gamble and Starbucks and Walmart, they really are. And we can have a bigger discussion about why, but I don't think we should fall into this thinking of...
Wait for a mic. Here it comes. Tell us who you are.
They may be setting up... Oh, hi, I'm Robin. I work for a company that helps brands listen. So, but But you know, I would say that, you know, as much as I would like it to be different, because I do work for a company that helps brands listen, they're conducting small experiments, some bigger than others, but you know, they're still selling, FMCG brands in particular, still spending billions on TV, as I think they probably should, because I do take on board your point. I suppose if I'm going to turn this into a question, and perhaps it's to Neil, is you know, this fragmentation in audiences, which is driving down, you know, big media companies' revenues, which is therefore making it harder for them to employ the same staff and therefore create the same content they used to create. What does that mean for our culture? You know, I think brands and our economy will be fine, but what does that mean to us as individuals that like to consume, you know, the BBC Newsnight or Coronation Street, for example?
The word culture was in that question.
Yeah, I'm terrified of that. No, it's just, I think you're already seeing some interesting things happening where essentially ITV's, the commissioning editors there are saying, we can't commission the big budget programmes which people enjoy watching. You know, coming back, and I suppose the kind of question which is asked, why can't we see dramas like CSI, you know, the big budget, glitzy, 24-episode runs that you see imported from the US? And they say, well, frankly, we just can't afford to make them. It's essentially the message you appear to be hearing. So maybe that's the first result of this kind of fragmentation. I mean, for people like us, fragmentation doesn't feel like it's happening, because we've gone from being a newspaper which sold maybe 400,000 copies a day on average to having 8 million uniques in the UK, some of them, of course, many of them only coming in for one page, but, you know, bear with me, these are the numbers, and 20 million worldwide. So we kind of feel actually nothing's fragmented there at all. It's a big clumping together of tons and tons of people who were never reading us before. So it's kind of working both ways. But I think, you know, to answer the terrifying cultural bit of your question, I think it does begin to beg the question then, well, if you want to see really the really big hits, are you relying on public service publishing of stuff you're funded by tax or license fees? Are you relying on importing that and huge aggregation of audience through syndication, in which case we're getting an awful lot coming from the States? There's a variety of questions around all that.
Right. While Neil's got the mic, I want to ask a sort of nitty-gritty question. I want to know, and especially because you represent the only conventional media business on the panel, or at least you come from that background. So what I want to know is how, as a media owner, as a developer of huge amounts of content, what's the evaluative process? How do you decide which content and which functionality to push out into these new platforms and to push out into what we're calling micromedia?
It's a process we're only beginning to start to look at. So we're kind of feeling our way and looking for where we think actually the content might be most appropriate. So we know that people, when they want to share one of our videos at the moment, and this is an embarrassment, they have to actually rip it and then they stick it in YouTube. And we're overjoyed that they choose to do that. That is wonderful, and I have absolutely no qualms. I mean, I don't speak for the company there, but, you know, I think generally I'm really delighted that they like our stuff sufficiently to stick it on YouTube, and we're going to try and get a share button put in there. And the same for our audio and things. We want to be able to push that out, and we think that, you know, we're really interested in getting more people to hear our stuff. It's part of the, we're lucky because we don't have shareholders paying for quarterly results, so we can focus on, we really want to get our stuff out there. We want to become this global liberal voice, and we think that part of that is pushing our content out. It's also about creating, distributing the ways we actually create stuff and how we build technical widgets and all the rest. It's about not just building that from the centre as well. So partly the community might help us find our way. I mean, we've had a slightly sad story. We thought we'd, really simple, really basic stuff, put our technology RSS feed to full fat, all the stories in the RSS feed. We thought our users would really like that. They've been kind of, one or two of them have been demanding it for years. And so holding back is tricky. We did that, and there was no ethereal singing, no fanfares, just the complaints started rolling in about how we'd fattened up the feed and it was unreadable, and, you know, could you please stop doing that now?
Did you roll it back?
We haven't rolled it back yet. We're seeing what happens, because, of course, most people never complain, and maybe people will like it. Who knows?
You'll get that done for 09 or something like that.
10.
I find it fascinating to watch this. Now, listen, let's see if we can go to one of the newer players on the panel. Before we go back to the audience, I want to know how you go about actually exposing content for these widget people. Presumably, we're talking about APIs. Yeah, Mitch?
Yeah. So we've got a a developer platform, a place where developers who want to build applications or widgets or a combination of the two, if that exists, can actually log in and you know, read the information. They can test their application against our, you know, there's a test harness there. There's a way of seeing how it's working. And there's examples in there. All the code is open. So for any application that's already been built on our site, another developer can go in and crack it open, see how it works, and copy it and try something slightly different. Or they can, you know, see something, you know, try something a whole new way. So there's we've got, you know, loads and loads of documentation, information, but it's all built around a forum. It's all built around the idea that it's a community of people helping each other to make the internet a better place, to make MySpace better, to make the websites that it's connecting to a better place. And I mean, I know it sounds kind of hippie utopia, but it really, I mean, it generally seems to be working like that.
Yeah, well, it's got Rupert Murdoch in it, so obviously I buy the whole hippie utopia thing.
Well, he likes it. He likes it because users are happy with it. And if users are happy, then they're coming back to our site. So.
And Neil at The Guardian, do you plan to permit that level of engagement with developers yourselves? Is there a Guardian API?
There's not a Guardian API, but
get on with it, man.
next. After we've just turned off that full technology RSS feed. Yeah.
Okay. Listen, have we got any more questions from the floor now? We've got they're beginning to blossom. We've got two I can see right now. I'm going to go to the back first, and then to this gentleman on the front sofa. Right over. That's a different one. That's a third one. You'll be third. So over there in the corner there, waving his hand vigorously. Microphone coming over to you by means of P2P transport. There you go. Tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm from AKQA. Question to Miles at Last FM. I'm wondering to what extent you actually need to worry about the other concerns that other media agencies would have, or sorry, media owners or media companies, because you've presumably got a big affiliate model that you could leverage as well. And what I mean by that is that I'm a massive Last FM fan and a massive music geek, and the value of your site to me is not as a media provider at all. It's what it knows about my music taste, in that actually it knows more about my music taste than I do. And so if I'm wondering, I fancy going out to a new gig, or if I want to buy something new, then Last FM can tell me what to buy, be it a concert ticket or a CD. And if I buy a concert ticket from your site, I'd certainly hope that you would get a share of that profits, because you deserve to. So to the Havas point earlier about creating a value before you can extract from it, then I think you've done that. And I wonder what sort of percentage of your future income could come from more of an affiliate model rather than a media model.
Yeah, you've hit a nail on the head, really. But first of all, AIS, you support us, so thank you very much. But I think from a point of view of where we are, yeah, you're absolutely right. You have a profile, you listen to music, and through the black box of tricks that this guy, 25-year-old guy, built at Southampton University, we know about the music you like that 25 million people around the world also listen to. I can't give you percentages of our revenue streams, but revenue streams from the affiliate partnership are bigger than advertising. And I think recently, some of you may have seen the press release that went out that since we launched, February 25th, we launched Free On Demand, the world's biggest jukebox. You can listen to songs on demand. So you haven't got to listen to the radio stream and hope your favorite song come up. You can put a name of the song in, and you can play the whole damn thing. At that point, we managed to get record labels to agree to this. Don't know how that happened. But sales, Amazon, of those songs from our links went up 120%. So it's a really good indication, and I think you're right. And also, interestingly, I've been speaking to a chap called Anthony Rind in the planning and strategy team about the very nature of taking this data. We have terabytes of this damn stuff. And taking that to advertisers and agencies and saying, look, you know, here you have a lot of music lovers around the world listening to this kind of music. How can that fit into building brands? And again, I haven't got the answers, but you know, if Madonna through Live Nation is promoting a Unilever product, and the music is pushing the product, which is pushing the music, at what point does music then become really important to the creative? And you know, there's a lot of ads out there where the music is an integral part of the creative. So it's an interesting proposition, but you're right. We do know a lot about people, and those affiliate revenues can be quite large.
And you promised not to screw it up by feeding ads into the stream.
For dog food.
Right, next, we have a question down here on the front, if we can get a mic. Tell us who you are.
Hello. Hello? Yeah. Yep. I'm Cara. I've got two hats on because I make music, so I'm interested in that. But I'm also, my company builds websites, so... But I'm interested in asking Neil, I guess what we're talking about is potentially like an antagonistic relationship between the new and the old manifestations of media. Do you see that as being true? Do you see the digital product eventually phasing out the paper product? How you see that happening, when that would happen, why, you know, what the indicators would be for that happening?
I think print and online will coexist for a very long time, and you know, people make crazy predictions about what's going to happen to print over the next few years. I really think it's going to be around for a very long time, and it suits people in a particular way, and you know, it's very difficult to see when all that stops. Our editor's on record as saying he thinks he's bought his last set of presses, that he bought a new set of presses in 2005. They generally last about 20 years, so we can all do the maths and work out, you know. But that doesn't mean the end of newspapers. It just means he thinks that's what, you know, bought last set of presses. So clearly there's a huge shift online. The ad revenue growth is piling on online. It's not, that's, you know, obviously not the case in print, although things are holding up pretty well. So we're at a state of flux. I think the thing for us is we're at the moment going through a process where we're amalgamating print and online journalists, and you're going to find people working for both platforms and whichever new platforms come along as well. So it's a question about just telling the story in the best way possible, whichever platform there is to tell it on. And print's going to be really good for telling lots of stories and doing very different things to online. So I come from a print background, so I can't just knock it in the head and say, walk away from it. You know, I still love print.
Thanks, Neil. I think we have a question over here in the blue shirt.
It's James Cooper. Just a quick question for mainly for MySpace. So you mentioned the whole YouTube thing, and that's one of the first sort of mainstream examples of widgets, etc. And you know, shortly after that, and it really came through MySpace, people posting it on there. The COO of News Corp, Peter Chernin, said, you know, YouTube has built a $1 billion business off the back of, you know, our network, and we're never going to let anyone do this again. You know, we're going to lock it down. And you know, you had all sorts of things of people being chucked off the platform. And now, you know, fast forward a couple of years or whatever, it's 18 months, and you have a, you know, very much more open developer platform and, you know, APIs, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, what convinced a guy like Peter Chernin to sort of change his mind on this whole micromedia widgets thing?
The users, the individual, you know, the people that were saying that this is the way we want to use media, this is the way we want to use media going forward. And they showed it with how they were customizing their profile, the way they were customizing things. And the challenge for us was, how do we build a safe and secure enough environment so that we can protect our users' information and still allow external parties, you know, a way to integrate and to build things. And we're now extending that beyond just the developer platform, but we're actually, you know, with data availability, we're going to start allowing our users to put their information on other websites. So if a website doesn't want to build a social network, a brand, for example, doesn't want to build a social network, but wants the social networking activity that goes around, then, you know, they can build those plugins, and users can then carry their information with them and participate in other places with their MySpace information, their videos, their photos, their friends, their, who they are, their default photo, those types of things. And I think that's where it really starts to get more interesting for third parties, not just in the widget economy, but how that information that's all cycling around, you know, in MySpace now spinning out and going out into other areas.
Thank you. There's a lady just behind. Oh, there's a man, in fact, up there. It's already got a microphone. Goodness me. Go ahead.
Hi there.